Good morning. Welcome to Prairie Unitarian Universalist Society. I am Sandy Ingham, the part-time minister here. Prairie tries to be an open-hearted and open-minded congregation, and we generally succeed. We welcome you, no matter what your ethnic or religious background, no matter your color, your sexual orientation, your gender preference, or your family structure, no matter your age or your abilities or inabilities. We do urge you to come, if this is one of your first times here, to try to come to more than one service because the services are different every Sunday. Sometimes I do them, obviously. Sometimes someone from the outside of Prairie does them, and sometimes we have a speaker from within our Prairie community. We do have a time when you will be invited, if you're new or a visitor, to introduce yourself if you want to. We try not to really pressure you too much into doing that. That will happen later in the service. These then are the opening words, and they are the words of Mother Teresa. Love cannot remain by itself. It has no meaning. Love has to be put into action, and that action is service. Whatever form we are, able or disabled, rich or poor, it is not how much we do, but how much love we put in the doing, a lifelong sharing of love with others. We light our flaming chalice to illuminate the world we seek, and hopefully not to set the flowers on fire. In the search for truth, may we be just. In the search for justice, may we be loving. And in loving, may we find peace. For this weekend before Valentine's Day, I have a reading taken from Unitarian Universalist minister Robert Fulghum's book, True Love, Stories Told to and by Robert Fulghum. This one was told to him. When I was a junior in college, this is a male talking, I took a course in the writing of D.H. Lawrence. I know this sounds really stupid, but I thought this was about Lawrence of Arabia. You know, the eccentric British desert warrior guy. I had seen the movie, and I wanted to be him. I was not fully alert in college. I went down to the local used bookstore to get everything they had. I was a little surprised by the titles, The Rainbow, Women in Love, Sons and Lovers, and Lady Chatterley's Lover. There was a side of Lawrence of Arabia I didn't know about. The clerk explained, whoa, bad news, but I had registered for the course, and now I had the books. And I needed the credits, so I was stuck. I went home to read. Like a lot of college students, I bought used books, hoping someone else would have already underlined the important stuff. The Lawrence books I bought were thoroughly underlined, and when I flipped through and read some of the paragraphs about making out, I was blown away. This was really hot stuff. To hell with the other Lawrence and the desert. This Lawrence was my kind of guy. And I figured that any girls who were taking this course would be my kind of girls. All the books I bought had the same female name in the front. I figured this girl must have taken the course and then sold the books. She really knew what to underline, not just the juicy parts, but the really beautiful passages that were about love, not just sex. I looked her name up in the telephone book. Does everybody still know what a telephone book is? Okay. And she was there. I figured I'd just call her up and see what happened. I was hoping for anything from a date to copies of the papers she had written. College guys play all the angles. I called her up, introduced myself, and told her what I wanted. Whoa, again, she was not a girl, but a retired college professor of English literature. These books were extras she had sold when she moved to a smaller apartment. She laughed and said she would be glad to have a date with me, and she would explain about Lawrence and tell me how to pass the course. We liked each other right away. She lived alone, and her eyes were failing. She said if I would drive her to the grocery store once a week, she would tutor me in Lawrence. During that semester, she woke me up about love and sexuality and women. I spent a lot of time with her. I'm a better man because of her. A long time later, I told her if she had been 20 instead of 70, I would have asked her to marry me. She said she would have accepted. She's dead now. I still have her books and her wisdom and her kind of love. I got an A in the course, too. Recently, tennis star Serena Williams said, "I play for love of the game. And it is with that love in mind and a new understanding of the true meaning of forgiveness that I will proudly return to Indian Wells in 2015. I'm a tennis nut. Indian Wells is a tennis tournament in California, which Williams has boycotted for several years because last time she played there, she got booed. I love tennis. I have spent many hours of my life on the tennis courts. I love bicycling. I especially love hiking in and out of Grand Canyon. I love climbing up and down those amazing rock formations in Zion National Park. I love Door County. I love dark chocolate, too, and avocados, oh, and all kinds of nuts. Oh, and by the way, I loved that movie, something about the Marigold Hotel, and there's going to be another one. Oh, and I really love many books, including To Kill a Mockingbird, oh, and the movie, too, and, oh, there's going to be another To Kill a Mockingbird, kind of, because apparently Harper Lee did write another book, and it's just been rediscovered, and it will be printed soon. Oh, I'm going to love that book. We toss around that word love a lot, don't we? Surely I don't mean that I love chocolate and tennis and hiking in the same way that I love my children and my grandchildren and prairie. No, of course I don't. The problem with using the word love so freely and to mean so many different things, so many different levels of caring, is that the word can become meaningless. Or does it become meaningless? If we pay attention to how and when we use the word love, I think the word could serve as an entry-level word of sorts to lead us into reflecting on two other words, empathy and compassion. When I was in seminary, I took a class, an entire semester class, on the Holocaust. The professor excuse me, who usually taught it and who always got rave reviews for this class, was on sabbatical the semester that I took the class. Perhaps I should have waited until he returned because I ended up clashing with the professor from whom I took the class. He insisted, the professor I had, that the Diary of Anne Frank served absolutely no purpose whatsoever for understanding the Holocaust. I disagreed. I said it could serve a purpose on at least two levels. It could be the first time someone learned about the Holocaust, and that would be very important, I think. At least they would know about it. But it could also be an entry level, a beginning place, a starting point into further complexities of how this could have happened in the middle of the 20th century. Now, I'm not sure that my experience in that class is comparable to my saying that the word love can serve as an entry level word on the road to better understanding compassion, but I think that there are similarities. You may start with the mundane, but if you're paying attention, I'm going to be very Buddhist this morning. If you are paying attention, you will discover more and more about love, about human nature, about humanity. Here is part of what I wrote for the February newsletter about this morning's service. Besides being the title of a song with a tune that can cause an earworm, what's love got to do with it? Okay, there, that's in there, right? Okay. What does that word love have to do with it? Our everyday lives. We use this word frequently and loosely, but can it lead to bigger and better concepts, such as empathy and compassion? I've touched on this in some of my most recent reflections, but I would like to attempt to go deeper into the subject of love on this Sunday before Valentine's Day. In mid-February, we celebrate love in a strange sort of way in this country when Valentine's Day occurs. We can easily dismiss this day, and many of us probably do, as a Hallmark card holiday, something designed by not only the greeting card companies, it's probably keeping greeting cards in business at Mother's Day and Father's Day, but also designed possibly by florists, jewelers, manufacturers of candy, the list of those who benefit financially, and Orange Tree Imports, from I don't usually give you an infomercial, but once in a while I try to get in there. The list of those who benefit financially from Valentine's Day is fairly long, and not necessarily a bad thing. And it would probably have to include Robert Fulghum, at least when his book True Love was first published. I should mention, however, that Habitat for Humanity got all the net royalties from the sale of that book of his. I actually like Valentine's Day. I have always liked it, even when I haven't had a particular Valentine in mind. I like having fun with it, as in discovering the stories in Fulghum's book. Well, then there's that chocolate aspect of Valentine's Day, of course. But I even like those stupid little candies. Are they still out there? They're still made? I don't like to eat them, they're awful, but I like to read the slogans, they're hilarious. You can make little sentences with them. You can make paragraphs with them. I like anything that helps me counter the winter blahs and escape the gray days for a while. This year, though, I decided that I would try to mark Valentine's Day by celebrating compassion. You may remember, some of you, that I did a service on compassion earlier this year. In mid-October, I mean, when I say this year, I mean the church year, the school year, I think in terms of semesters, September through May. I did that service, it's titled Conflicted About Compassion. But on that Sunday, I barely scratched the surface of the complexity of compassion because there's just never enough time. If I were doing a PowerPoint presentation, which I usually hate right now, I would only use one graphic. There'd be the word love and an arrow, the word empathy, an arrow, and then the word compassion. Love, at its best, can hopefully lead to empathy. Empathy, at its best, can then lead, hopefully, to compassion. Empathy is compassion ratcheted up. In the story For All Ages, the villagers made it to empathy when so many of them contributed to the making of that stone soup, and then again when everybody in the village sat down together to eat the soup. But did those villagers make it to compassion in the process? Did they really understand each other and the fears that kept them apart. One of the things that I mentioned in those October reflections was that scientists are beginning to think that compassion is an integral part of human nature. And I also use this phrase, compassion is the fulfillment of human nature. I told you then that statement came from Karen Armstrong in her book, 12 Steps to a Compassionate Life. Most of you are familiar with Armstrong by now, I think. Theologian, author, very contemporary. She says that compassion is part of human nature, natural to human beings. She didn't just arrive at this one day. You know, she didn't have a moment when God or somebody spoke to her. She did a lot of study to reach this conclusion. Think about that statement. Compassion is the fulfillment of human nature. That statement blows me away. When I used it in October, and I'll have to give these remarks to Rosemary Lester, because there was some discussion in the congregational response time about that statement, and Rosemary said she did not believe it at all. So I'm hoping we'll get into the discussion again a little bit this morning. Do you believe that compassion is the fulfillment of human nature? And if you were here in October, you might remember that I talked about the conflict, the tension between our old brain way of thinking, which was necessary to survive for most of human history, and the development of the new brain way of thinking, which is now necessary if we're going to survive on this planet. How do we get to new brain, which has everything to do with the interconnectedness of everything? And, you know, Unitarian Universalists should be way ahead of the game here, because this is at the bedrock of what we believe. How do we get to new brain before we destroy the planet? We cultivate compassion. We study it. We intentionally put compassion into practice every day as often as we can. Well, we humans are strange creatures, aren't we? In a coffee shop a few days ago, a young man, 4 or 5 years old, walked by my table, and of course he's about the height of the table, and he informed me that, quote, "We are walking through muck." Furthermore, he went on, "We have to walk in the muck right now." Well, he was referring to, you know, that muck on the floor when we all traipse in and out of places and the snow's melting and the salt and the sand and yada yada. He was being literal, as 4 and 5 year olds tend to be. But we adults trudge through muck and murkiness every day, metaphorically speaking, usually. One day last week, on the same day, I started a Spanish class, something I've been wanting to do forever, at Madison Area Technical College. We went around the room and said why we were there. It was fantastic. It was like being in a global village. I mean, there was someone who owned a landscaping business who was there so she could better converse with her employees. There was a man who works with kids, at-risk kids, and he's seeing more and more Hispanic, Latina people, and he wants to be better able to communicate with them. It was all about expanding who we are and practicing compassion. Later on that day, I went to a movie. I went to American Sniper. I don't know how many of you have seen it, but it's not about the global village. It's about the undoing of the global village, I guess we could say. But you can, I could at least, understand why the sniper was doing what he was doing, but it's pretty awful and intense. 2 Sundays ago, the New York Times had a story about an odd thing that is happening in Africa, in coastal areas. Some of you may have seen it. Mosquito nets, meant to be hung over beds, of course, to keep mosquitoes out and to drastically cut the rate of malaria, are now being used as fishing nets. The rate of malaria is going up and up. This is sort of compassion run amok, you might say. Here was a project that started out with the best of intentions and then became something else, something that is causing problems as big as malaria, if not more so. For one thing, those nets aren't meant to be put in water, and it says in the instructions, do not rinse in rivers or streams because of what they're treated with. So it's destroying fish population, but the people are harvesting so many little fishes that there's a great worry that there will be the destruction of different kinds of species. And of course, then they have to often turn around and drink that water that's full of the chemicals that were used to treat the nets. So, you could say maybe it was a case of practicing empathy while neglecting to practice compassion. Humans spend a lot of time and energy walking through muck, even when we are trying to walk down a clear path and do the right thing. Before I share two stories about true compassion, I want to emphasize two important components that I did not cover in October. First, developing compassion starts with ourselves. I missed that Moses meeting yesterday morning because I'm such a procrastinator, and I needed the muse to strike so I could start writing. But then I beat up on myself. That's counterproductive. Practicing compassion starts right here. Thich Nhat Hanh tells us, love is the capacity to take care, to protect, to nourish. If you are not capable of generating that kind of energy toward yourself, it is very difficult to take care of another person. In the Buddhist teaching, it's clear that to love oneself is the foundation of the love of other people. And I would add to what Thich Nhat Hanh said, I believe that this foundation, loving ourselves, is also the necessary foundation for responding to mental illness and to addictions. The second necessary component in the development of compassion is this: we cannot be afraid to confront the suffering and pain within ourselves, nor the suffering and pain in the world. Cultivating compassion requires that we be in touch with, that we sit with sorrow and sadness, anguish over the state of the world. This is all part of the process. Recognizing what we often call the, unfortunately, the dark emotions helps us to tell a different story about who we are as human beings. To quote a man named Thubten Jinpa, this work is not easy, but embracing the sorrow and the unfairness of life will take us to a truer understanding of compassion. Thubten Jinpa is the main translator for the Dalai Lama. He is right in the thick of the current conversation between Western science and Buddhism about the true nature of humans. You wouldn't believe how much is going on out there in this area and the studies that are happening. Jinpa has developed a compassion training program at Stanford University. The basic premise of this training is fairly simple, he writes. It is based on the premise that compassion is an important part of our fundamental nature. By becoming more aware of and connecting with our inherent compassion, we learn to relate to ourselves, to others, and to the world around us from that side of our nature. But Thubten Jinpa says it is difficult for people in Western cultures to truly believe that compassion is a very important part of our nature because we're conditioned to believe that the ultimate motivation driving all of our behavior is self-interest. And please note, developing compassion for ourselves is not the same thing as being motivated by self-interest. Jinpa says that we're going against the grain, we're going against the current when we talk about compassion in the West. Have you seen anything about compassion in the news lately? But as he puts it, science is increasingly telling us that while the pursuit of self-interest is a powerful drive, the instinct for nurturing, caring, and connection is equally powerful. Ah, we humans, we complex creatures who have both of those powerful drives. Now let's suppose that you were able to attend one of these 8-week sessions of Stanford Compassion Training. Imagine, after completing the training, you, Anne, have an opportunity to have a one-on-one with Governor Walker. Or the Koch brothers. Well, how would you do? Could you find common ground? I was raised Republican, and I'm quite pleased with that. In 1972, I worked on the McGovern presidential campaign. I was hanging out with a bunch of Democrats, and they convinced me that it would look great to have Republicans for McGovern. This is a very small town in northwestern Pennsylvania, kind of rural. I was probably the only Republican for McGovern in town. Except, back in those days, you went door to door and people were home. Usually a woman, but you know, because not everybody worked. My son was 6 or 7, and he still has a very clear memory of this. We would go into people's homes and we would talk about policies, politics, the breaking story of Watergate. So I worked one ward in this town. It was a Republican ward. It went for McGovern. You have to find the common ground. How do we communicate effectively with those people with whom we disagree? How do we go from having self-interest be the basis of our communicating to having compassion be the base out of which we operate? How do we interact with those who push our buttons, who often seem to us to have no redeeming value? How do we relate to the other, those people whom we can't stand, let alone tolerate, whom we actually might hate? How do we interact with them to move the discussion from either or to both and? Bernie Glassman is a man who was an engineer and a mathematician working in the aerospace industry until he trained to be a Zen Buddhist. To say that it changed his life would be an understatement. Glassman now does many things to cultivate compassion, including establishing profit-making companies that put those profits back into trying to house the homeless and help the homeless. Glassman, for the last 20 years, has been leading what he calls bearing witness retreats at a place, these are his words, that represents the most terrible case of what we do to those outside our club. These retreats are held at Auschwitz. The theme of the retreats, he tells us, is not the Holocaust. The theme is, how do we deal with each other? He sat with people who come to these retreats on those railroad tracks that took people into Auschwitz concentration camp. He has sat with survivors. He has sat with people who are younger from Germany and from all over the world, figuring out what true compassion is by acknowledging and respecting the anguish and the sorrow in the world. Glassman says that if we are liberal, we never listen to conservatives or read books by them or invite them to tea. And if we're conservative, vice versa. We all form our own clubs. The most common thing we do to people that don't fit our club is we avoid them. We also imprison them. Sometimes we beat them up. In the South, we used to lynch them. Gays, we bash them. I would love to see us get to the place where we are not bashing anyone, especially within these walls. Not even our governor, or the Koch brothers, or any of those Tea Party Republicans. We humans have to figure out how to find common ground, and equally important, how to get beyond our fears. Fear plays a huge role in this. We'll do fear another day. I've already done fear once, but there's lots more to say about fear. Do any of you remember hearing, it's probably been years ago now, a piece of reporting on National Public Radio where women from opposite sides of the abortion debate were brought together to try, the purpose of bringing them together was to try to find common ground. What could they agree on? Anybody remember that? It was fascinating. I'm not going to tell you the answer. Here are two short stories about the art of compassion. I will include my reflections with these and with one ancient fable. But these two short stories were told by Rebecca Parker, recently retired president of Starr King School for the Ministry, author, theologian, Unitarian Universalist, and Methodist minister. In these stories, Parker reminds us that compassion is a means of restoring human beings to the music of life. First story. At the end of World War II, Lyle Grunkenmeyer came home to Iowa. His mother and sister waited for his return. The day he came home, the only veteran to return alive to that town, everyone came out to meet him. As the train pulled into the station, the band played and the mayor was there to shake his hand. But as his sister later told me, that man who climbed off the train was not the lively, cheerful boy who had left for war. He was a ghost. He didn't seem to recognize anyone, not his mother, sister, or friends. In response to the crowd's rousing welcome, he stared mutely, blank. His family took him home to the farm, where he sat in the old rocking chair in the parlor. He did not speak or move and could barely eat. He continued in this state for days that spilled into weeks, that flowed into months. No one in this town knew about post-traumatic shock. They only knew that Lyle's soul was lost somewhere. Lyle's sister Maxine decided to stay by him. Whenever she could, she would come and sit with him, and she would talk. She'd tell him about the church potluck and who was there, and she'd tell him what each young woman wore. She'd tell him about some conversation she heard in town. She told him about how the wind had blown the clean laundry into the tomatoes. But when she ran out of things to say, she would simply sit with him, snapping beans, mending socks. And he sat there, silent, like a stone, rocking. One night, while Maxine was knitting quietly beside him, Lyle's eyes filled with tears. The tears spilled over and ran down his frozen face. Maxine went to her brother and put her arms around him. Held in his sister's embrace, he began to cry, full force, great sobs of anguish bursting from deep inside him. Then he began to talk, and he would not stop. He talked of the cold, the fear, the noise, the death of his buddies, the long marches, and then the human beings in the camps, the mass graves, the smell. He talked all night until the dawn light began to creep across the fields. Maxine listened to everything Lyle had to say. Then she went into the kitchen and she cooked him breakfast. They ate together. And then Lyle went out and did the morning chores. Second story. In Seattle in the early 1980s, writes Rebecca Parker, I served the Wallingford United Methodist Church at a time when anti-gay sentiment was heating up in our city. Our denomination, this is when she was a Methodist minister, our denomination had just banned the ordination of lesbian and gay people, and the congregation decided to take a proactive stand in supporting them. The lesbian and gay people, not the denomination. We wanted to express hospitality and welcome, but we quickly discovered that those who had been kicked out of church weren't going to return just because we hung out a welcome sign. There was no basis for trust that we meant what we said. How did people know that we weren't trying to lure them into the church so we could then convict them of their sin? No one just came to church. They called first. Testing the waters, they asked, is this the church that says lesbian and gay people are welcome? At first, we did not always know if the caller was a person looking for a church that was genuinely welcoming or someone who felt our stand was wrong and wanted to make sure we knew exactly where hell was and how close we were to falling in. Nina, our church administrator, became highly adept at handling these calls. In response to the opening question, she would carefully explain our church's stand. We accepted people of diverse sexual orientations. We welcomed people as they were, and the fellowship of our church and its activities was fully open to all. She told me that eventually every caller would come around to saying, "The real reason I'm calling is." One day, the caller said, "The real reason I'm calling is that I am a man, but I like to dress up in women's clothes. What I want to know is, if I come to church in a dress, will I be welcome?" Nina pondered for a second and said, "Is it a really ugly dress?" The next Sunday, the caller did come to church, wearing a lovely red Chanel suit, complete with hat and gloves. She was warmly welcomed. This Valentine's Day, I urge you to read the Charter for Compassion at charterforcompassion.org. So that's your homework. And then I also urge you to remember this bit of ancient wisdom. It's a wonderful little fable. Let's see if I can do it. It said that a pagan approached the great Rabbi Hillel and promised to convert to Judaism if he, Hillel, could recite the entire Torah while he stood on one leg. Hillel replied, "What is hateful to yourself, do not to your fellow man. That is the whole of the Torah, and the remainder is but commentary. Go study it." We would call that the golden rule. That story from long ago gives me hope, as do those current stories and reports about what is happening right now on planet Earth to find our true nature, compassion. And perhaps this Valentine's Day can remind us of the importance of loving ourselves first and then moving into cultivating compassion for the entire world. Practice what the Buddhist tradition suggests, that you could actually make compassion your standpoint, the perspective from which you relate to the world. Compassion becomes part of your intention of being in the world, and in this way, you start making it real. Thank you. And Jim, I think that we're not all at the same place with compassion. Robin Voss maybe has an evolved, no wait, I don't want to say it quite that way, but you know, it's innate, but it's not always brought out, depending on so many things, the way we grew up, and subject for another day. All right, unfortunately, we are out of time, but this is one of those subjects, and in fact, Matt Tedesco, is either you, I think, or Jim Line, who asked when I did this in October, about starting a discussion group about compassion. It might have been Jim. But there are so many things we could have discussion groups about. We don't have to confine ourselves to Sunday mornings. The closing words are from Alice Walker. "Love is not concerned with whom you pray or where you slept the night you ran away from home. Love is concerned that the beating of your heart should kill no one." Greet your neighbor, enjoy Valentine's Day, spread compassion.